Good morning. Welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. My name is Andrew Cutchins. I'm director of the Russia and Eurasia program here. I apologize for our late start today. It seems that I was the one that had a little problem with the snooze button this morning. We have a joke around here at CSIS about the Russian-Ukrainian gas crisis that is attributed to the director of the Energy and National Security Program, Frank Verastro. And that is that 3 years ago, with the first Russo-Ukrainian gas crisis, Europe got a wake-up call, but then pressed the snooze button. And here we are 3 years later, and we have a second gas crisis, similar in some ways and different in others, and I think surprising to most of us in its duration. We have a really fantastic panel this morning to talk about the nature of this dispute, and also to think about how we can avoid pressing the snooze button once again and find ourselves in the same situation next year or sometime in the future. Let me introduce all three of our panelists. First to my left is Ed Chow, a senior fellow at the CSIS Energy Program. He is an international energy expert with 30 years of industry experience. He's worked in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, South America, Europe, the former Soviet Union. It's pretty much everywhere, Ed.
Not North America.
Not North America.
Don't ask me about North America.
Okay. specializing in government policy and business strategy, particularly on investments in emerging economies and international oil and gas negotiations. He spent 20 years of his career with the Chevron Corporation in the United States and overseas. Steve Pfeiffer, next to Ed, is a retired Foreign Service officer, more than 25 years in the State Department, focused on U.S. relations with the former Soviet Union and Europe, as well as on arms control and security issues. His many assignments included Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs from 2001 to 2004, where he had principal responsibility for policy toward Russia and Ukraine. Steve also served as ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000. and before that, he was on the National Security Council, senior director for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, in 1996-1997, where he advised the president, vice president, and national security advisor on policy toward the former Soviet Union. Our third and last speaker, John Elkind, is an independent consultant on energy, environment, and investment. He has advised BP in relation to its projects in the Caspian region, including the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline. From 1998 to 2001, John served on the staff of the U.S. National Security Council. Before that, he worked on the National Security Affairs Staff, the U.S. Vice President, and coordinated the U.S. Department of Energy's cooperative programs with Russia and Ukraine. So that is our distinguished panel this morning. It's my understanding that Ed is going to lead off and talk a bit about the issue from more of a commercial industry standpoint. Steve will then take over and lay out some of the political and diplomatic implications and measures from the crisis. And John is going to bat cleanup and tell us how we're going to avoid this in the future. So with no further ado, Ed, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Andy. In thinking about giving this talk, and before I throw a lot of facts and data that may be lost in a policy audience, I'm trying to think of
you don't think we care about facts and data?
not industry facts and data so much. Okay. I'm trying to think of a way of thinking about what happened in the last 3 weeks or so. And the best analogy that I can come up with is that there was a hockey game that was unnecessarily called into overtime. And both sides start scoring against themselves, scoring own goals. The spectators on the side, and here I'm thinking particularly of the Europeans, became more and more bewildered than usual every time Russia, Ukraine has a gas crisis. Then they turn off the heat in the arena, and the spectators started panicking. The reason I say this, and I'm going to talk about what we think we know about the deal and what is the resolution, at least the resolution version 09.1, of the never-ending, seemingly, Russian-Ukraine gas saga that has actually repeated itself numerous times since 1992, even before the January 2006 crisis. The reason I think of that analogy is because if you look at the end of 2008, Mr. Miller, head of Gazprom, was talking about a gas price for Ukraine of around $2.50 for the year 2009. Mr. Dubina of Naftahaz was talking about maybe $2.35 gas price per 1,000 cubic meter would be a number acceptable to Ukraine. Mr. Putin was talking about maybe we do need to increase the transit fee for Russian gas transiting Ukraine into Europe. So if that was the difference between 250 and 235, one wonders from the outside what the real problem is. You know, why can't you make a deal if you're that close in price? And what might that be? Are there some hidden issues that we don't know about? One that's often brought up is the role of the middlemen whose role was expanded as part of the January 2006 deal, which is Rosukrenergo, that some of you may have heard about, where the division on the Ukrainian side, negotiating side, particularly between the prime minister's and the president's camp, that caused the deal not to be able to be consummated at the end of 2008. It was puzzling why something couldn't go forward. And that's why I think that to outsiders it might seem odd that this game that should have ended on December 31st went into overtime. On January 1st, Russia reduced the gas volumes that would normally go to Ukraine as a New Year's Day present, I suppose. On January 7th, which by pure coincidence, I'm sure, was Orthodox Christmas, Russia cut off all gas flows, not only the volumes that would normally go to Ukraine, but all gas flows, period. One speculates that it may be because that if you only cut off the gas flows to Ukraine during the wintertime, Ukraine with gas in storage as well as domestic production can manage the domestic gas balance pretty well. You can't really affect Ukraine very much if you just cut off the gas volumes to Ukraine and let the volumes to Europe go as normal. So Russia decided to score its own goal by cutting all gas and trying to get more people's attention, certainly Europe's. At that point, EU monitors were invited to come and monitor from both governments. Of course, at that point, there was nothing to monitor, so it was very easy to invite monitors. Some of you may know that subsequently, after the deal was cut, both sides, Ukraine and Russia, decided they didn't need EU monitors anymore. Around January 14th, which has the virtue of being New Year on the old calendar, this is the way I remember these things. Russia decided to try two test cargoes of variously 77 million cubic meters or 99 million cubic meters, supposedly going the direction of Romania and Bulgaria, knowing full well that that kind of test cargo couldn't possibly physically work. So it's a rather cynical exercise, rather transparent, possibly another own goal. Gazprom and Naftahaz technical folks work very closely together when things are going normally. Gazprom understood very easily the capability of the Ukrainian gas system. Quite predictably, the resolution came into being when Prime Minister Tymoshenko flew to Moscow to see Prime Minister Putin on the 17th of January. With Orthodox Epiphany coming up, I think both sides really needed a deal because it's really hard to plunge into that river for Epiphany if you don't have a warm room to go back to. So they emerged at 2 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, the 18th, with a deal. Having been quite experienced in negotiating long, complicated agreements in the past, I tell you there's a distinct advantage of cutting a deal at 2 o'clock in the morning because then you can select the reporters you call. And the rest are still sleeping, so you can have a very nice, smooth press conference announcing a wonderful deal, the outbreak of solidarity of Slavic solidarity as well as Christian charity has overcome both sides, and now we have a deal so that on the 19th of January, Mr. Miller and Mr. Dubina was able to sign a deal, and gas started flowing on January 20th. I think the fact that it was January 20th must have been a coincidence. Now, the reason both sides came to a deal, I think, is because at that point, both sides really needed it. Russia was reporting revenue loss of over $1 billion at a rate of over $100 million per day. This is from both the Russian prime minister as well as the Russian president. Ukraine was really not able to handle its domestic gas balance anymore when all gas are cut off. Both sides were losing as either reliable gas supplier or as a reliable transit country. Europe was in an uproar. At that point, both sides needed a deal, and the deal was cut. Now, as a commercial negotiator by trade, I would tell you that you normally don't negotiate contracts that are with a contract value of over $10 billion per year in one or two nights. You normally don't even do it in 2 or 3 months. If this was Gazprom, we know this by real-life experience, if this was Gazprom negotiating a contract extension with E.ON or with E&I, a contract extension on the basis of existing contractual terms, it would take 1 to 2 years. That would be normal. So you don't do a deal in 1 or 2 nights. And so I think it really caused one to want to look at the details very, very carefully. As it happens, Orange Revolution with a free press is a wonderful thing. Ukrainska Pravda has nicely published a version on its website dated last Thursday that has very neatly Mr. Miller and Mr. Dubina's signatures on the document that they have on their website. And with a careful reading of that version, as well as reading the trade press, which gives a lot more detail than what the general press is interested in, and looking at quotes from people who should be in a position to know, Mr. Miller, Mr. Dubina, Prime Minister Timoshenko, Prime Minister Putin, I've come to certain conclusions of what we think we know and what we don't know. Now, I would say that I would caution that you're going to hear my concerns about gaps that of understanding or knowledge that may or may not have been reached, to criticize the negotiators so much as to understand how sustainable this deal actually is. Because what you worry about on a deal that's supposed to be a 10-year deal is that there is a misunderstanding, confusion, ambiguity that can cause the deal to derail, even though both sides needed a short-term truce, as I stated earlier. And that's your concern, is that something that's so hastily put together is sustainable in the very long run. So what do we think we know? There's a sales and purchase agreement that is 10 years in duration. It has an initial contract volume of 40 billion cubic meters for the year 2009, neatly put into bi-quarterly amounts, and a contractual volume for 2010 and onwards of 52 BCM. Interesting numbers, because this, these are numbers much smaller than the January 2006 agreement, which talked about 73 BCM. So it's 40 BCM for 2009, 2010, 52 BCM. It has a very well-specified take-or-pay obligation on the part of Ukraine. In other words, Ukraine is financially obligated to pay for a volume up to 80% of the stated. So that would be, for example, if for 2009, Ukraine will have to pay for 32 BCM of gas, whether it takes the gas or not. Whether it needs the gas or not, it's financially obligated to do that, and it is very quite clearly stated. It talks about a base price of $450 per 1,000 cubic meters. And that number is a little bit puzzling. Why 450 as the base price? Not clear from the documentation. The press often says that that's the European gas price. Well, the problem is there is no single European gas price. There's no single European gas contract. There's no single European gas price formula. There are numerous formulas, numerous buyers. Where did this 450 base price number come from? Not sure. But there is an 80% discount on that. So for Q1, then the number is deemed to be, as specified in the document, $360 per 1,000 cubic meters. And from then on, the price is supposed to be adjusted on a quarterly basis based on the movement of gas oil and 1% sulfur fuel oil, or mazut, in this part of the world. We know that there is a destination clause in the gas purchase agreement, which means that Ukraine does not have the right to re-export the gas that it buys from Gazprom. Which is a restriction that's clearly against European principles, against the principles of the rules that the European Commission would like to apply to all countries. Destination clauses are by their nature anti-competitive, and as well as violating the principles of the Energy Charter Treaty. Which are principles that Ukraine is supposed to be moving towards. There are quite well prescribed, and by the way, this document, which is 19 pages long, is a far superior document to the January 2006 fatally flawed agreement that was, John, 3 pages long? This document is clearly an improvement. Clearly prescribed penalties on non-performance by either side. There is a provision for a price reopener, which always troubles one, because under what circumstance then does either side demand a price reopener, because there's been a fundamental shift in market dynamics. Generally, one in commercial negotiations might try to get around that by agreeing to a price floor or price ceiling, so that you are the movement price adjustments are within an agreed range, rather than expose yourself to the possibility of a price reopener. So something to be watching out for the future. It seemed clear from the documents and from the subsequent statements of the principals that Rosuker and Energo's role as the monopoly gas importer for Ukraine is gone. That's what it seems. What we know about the Ukrainian market is that since Rosuker and Energo is no longer the monopoly importer, the question is, does that now be replaced by Naftahas, the state oil and gas conglomerate as the monopoly importer. I think that's implied, but not clear. I mean, for example, if you're an industrial consumer in Ukraine, would you be able to contract gas directly from Gazprom or from Novatek or from a Central Asian gas producer, as Ukraine used to do, without going through Naftahaz? Not clear, but it seems like Naftahaz will have to import monopoly. Therefore, Naftahaz also have the payment obligation. And the risk of non-payment looms even larger now than before. There are quite specific clauses in terms of if payment are late chronically, then there will be a risk of Gazprom demanding prepayment before gas is delivered to Ukraine. By the way, import monopolies clearly is once again one of these things that would be against the spirit of European standards on competition rules. 25% of the domestic market is to be ceded to Gazprom under these agreements and specified to industrial consumers. Another possibly anti-competitive clause, how do you cede 25% of a market? And why only to industrial consumers who, of course, are the consumers who actually pay in Ukraine on a regular basis? And does that mean that Naftahaz gets the utilities and the chronic non-payers as a result of this deal? What we know about the transit agreement is that the fee will remain $1.70 per 1,000 cubic meters per 100 kilometers for 2009. That number is supposed to go up to 2.04 for 2010. Why 2.04? No clear explanation. Thereafter to be adjusted annually according to EU inflation rate. Puzzling. Why EU inflation rate? What does EU inflation rate has to do with the cost of running a pipeline, upgrading a pipeline, maintaining a pipeline in Ukraine? What if EU inflation rate were negative, depending on what the next couple of years' economic performance does? Not clear why it's tied to EU inflation rate. If Naftahaz were to have a capital upgrade program, how would it be able to justify incorporating that into its tariff base? Apparently not possible under this particular agreement. Unlike Ukraine's take-or-pay obligation under the purchase agreement, there is apparently no ship-or-pay obligation on the part of Gazprom. The agreement loosely talks about the fact that Gazprom would like to ship not less than 110 BCM, but there doesn't seem to be a financial obligation to ship the 110 BCM on a ship-or-pay basis, or 80% of that volume, or however one might negotiate that. Some of you would have heard about this famous issue of technological gas or technical gas, which a particularly astute Belarusian analyst compares it with going to a cab and being asked by a cab driver to pay for the gas to run the cab. The transit agreement clearly states that technological gas is Naftahaz's responsibility and no one else's. But then we also hear about reports that there will be 11 BCM or so. Why 11 BCM? Not clear. That Gazprom will sell to Naftahaz at a price of $153.90. Again, where that price comes from, not clear. Is that on a one-off basis? Is it on an annual basis? What does that volume actually relate to? You might recall during the crisis, Ukraine claims that it needed 21 million cubic meters per day for technological gas purposes. If you multiply that against 365, unluckily, you don't get 11 or 12 BCM, you get 7.7 BCM. So where that number comes from, really not clear. I'm at a point of abusing my time pretty soon because I have a much longer list of things that I don't know about this agreement than what I think I do know. What we don't know is, for example, how the Ukrainian government most recently claims that Naftahaz will be buying gas at an annual average price of $228.80, very precise. How would they know that if no one knows what the fourth quarter price adjustment might be for 2009? It's not really clear. That doesn't seem like the Gazprom deal on the 25% of the domestic market contract has actually been signed. What happens to the $600 million late payment penalty that was so discussed at the end of last year? Mr. Firtash and of Rosneft claims that he's still going to file a claim on that. Normally, if you do a 10-year deal and both sides are acting in good faith, you kind of put in a whole harmless clause on your agreements to make sure that there are no counterclaims that you will be disputing afterwards in order to sustain the deal. Not clear whether that was done or not. I think it is clear that if both sides needed a 10-year agreement, that a lot of these provisions really need to be better clarified so that there's a firm understanding. When you have a publicly traded company like Gazprom is, that has, after all, a responsibility to shareholders to release material information that may affect its share value, one would expect normal regulatory agencies to make sure that there is a press release that makes clear some of these items. Similarly, when you have a company like Naftahaz, which is in technical default of its international bond obligations, as it is, you would expect bondholders to request to make sure that this information is clear to justify its current credit worthiness. Similarly, you would think that when Mr. Peebox was in Kiev on Tuesday, he might have demanded the same, and Mr. Barroso met with President Yushchenko today, he might have demanded the same since 80% of the Russian gas that goes to Europe actually transits Ukraine. So there is no more critical set of agreements for European gas security supply than these agreements. Once again, I would say that we know quite a bit more than we did before, but maybe not enough for us all to not stay awake, to continue that snooze button analogy and think that the crisis is over once and for all. We won't have to look at winter gas cutoffs between Russia and Ukraine anymore, particularly with a very political year coming up in Ukraine. And with that, Steve, I'm sure, is going to explain to us what this Friday's National Security and Defense Council meeting in Kiev, how it would address this set of gas agreements. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Like very much the hockey game metaphor. Of course, usually in American hockey, there are lots of fights on the ice, and makes me wonder who you think was having the biggest fights, maybe Mr. Yushchenko and Mrs. Tymoshenko. I don't know. I neglected to mention at the outset that this is a joint CSIS and Brookings event, and I'm really grateful to Steve, who's a visiting fellow in the foreign policy program at Brookings, and John, who's a senior fellow also in the foreign policy at Brookings and the Energy Security Initiative, for putting this together with us. So, Steve, what's going to happen later in the week?
Well, actually, we're going to let the future look be taken by John.
I'm going to talk
a little bit about the political dynamics both between Moscow and Kyiv, and then primarily within Kyiv. And I guess I would open with the observation that, you know, what you saw in the first half of January was not your normal commercial dispute, particularly between two entities, Gazprom and Naftogaz, which really in the long term or for the next 3 to 5 years need one another. As Ed said, about 80% of the gas that Russia exports to Europe goes through Ukraine. Were Gazprom to lose the use of the Ukrainian pipelines, it could move only about 30% of the gas by going through Belarus and down through Turkey that it's contracted to sell to Europe. And that's not going to change until Nord Stream or South Stream get built, and then I think there are some commercial questions about that. So, but at least for 3 to 4 or 5 years out, Gazprom and Russia need Ukraine as a transit country. Likewise, for the next 3 to 5 years, unless Ukraine really, or until Ukraine gets very serious about conservation of energy and developing domestic energy sources, Ukraine is going to need Russia for probably 70-65% of its gas imports. So you've got this relationship between two commercial entities and a fight that was unlike, I think, virtually any kind of commercial dispute you see anywhere else. And that reflects largely the fact that you had political factors involved on both sides. So let me start with the first set of observations, which is just to talk a little bit about the political posturing that you saw both in Moscow and Kyiv. And I would begin by looking at where Alexei Miller, the head of Gazprom, and Oleg Dubinina, the head of Naftogaz, spent most of their time in the first 2.5 weeks of January. They weren't spending a lot of that time across a conference table talking to one another. They were spending that time in Europe, in Brussels, in Berlin, and other capitals, on television, basically arguing the case that gas is not flowing and it's the other guy's fault. Now, Gazprom in Moscow began in January trying to say this is purely a commercial issue. We have a contract dispute with Ukraine. We have not yet agreed on the price, and it's unrealistic for us to expect to provide gas to Ukraine without that contract in place. Now, having set that argument out, the choreography that you saw in Moscow almost immediately demolished the argument, because what you saw on Russian television almost nightly was meetings between Mr. Miller and either President Medvedev or more likely Prime Minister Putin talking about this issue, and particularly the big decisions when Gazprom decided to reduce the gas flow to Ukraine because it said Ukraine was siphoning gas off, and then when Gazprom made the decision, or the decision was made, to stop all of the gas going into Ukraine. Those decisions were not taken by Mr. Miller. They were publicly taken by the Prime Minister of Russia. So this was not your normal commercial dispute. Likewise, when the first announcements of the January 17 gas summit in Moscow came out, there seemed to be a little bit of confusion, but it appears that the Russians initially did not invite the Ukrainians. So again, this looked like it was posturing in a way that was not designed to really solve the issue. I would add, by the way, I think it was actually very smart of the European Union to agree that their attendance in Moscow on January 17 would be limited to the Czech presidency and the EU Commission. I mean, I think that solidarity was useful in helping to bring this crisis to an earlier close. Now, Ukraine was also doing its own posturing. The choreography was not as well managed as in Moscow, but certainly there were a lot of appeals going out, the visit of the Polish president to Ukraine, but again, to try to posture this as, we're not at fault, it's a Russian problem. Now, a second set of observations about Russian political motives here, because I think there was a very clear Russian attempt to tarnish the political image of Ukraine, and part of a broader effort that I think we've seen over the past year to depict Ukraine as unreliable, to depict Ukraine as an unacceptable partner for Europe, for the European Union, and for NATO. Now, a couple motivations are behind this. First of all, I think the Russians were trying to use this to build support for the Nord Stream pipeline through the Baltic Sea and the South Stream pipeline through the Black Sea. I think both of those projects, you know, have some serious commercial questions because the cost of laying pipeline, you know, under the ocean is significantly greater than running pipelines across Ukraine and Belarus. So there's a motivation that's not just commercial but in part political to reduce the potential leverage that Ukraine might have in the future. But this also all plays out against a year in which Moscow has been thoroughly unhappy with Ukrainian foreign policy, beginning with January of last year when Ukraine announced its desire to get a membership action plan with NATO. You saw the rage in Moscow over how Ukraine in August, or at least President Yushchenko, very publicly sided with Georgia during the Russian-Georgia conflict. Yushchenko traveling to Tbilisi to stand by President Saakashvili on the fourth or fifth day of that conflict. Russian unhappiness about Ukrainian suggestions that they should begin negotiations now on the withdrawal of the Black Sea Fleet, and frustration about the way that the Holodomor was being portrayed, which Moscow very publicly said, you know, this is about trying to blacken Russia's image in the world. So there was this effort used by Russia, and I think a big motivation of why this commercial dispute dragged on beyond what it should have done had it just been a commercial issue was because of this political motivation. There was also, I think, from the Russian side, the appearance of an attempt really to discredit Viktor Yushchenko personally. I mean, of the people that were signaled out for Russian commentary, the commentary was particularly negative on Yushchenko. And the staging that was done in the end, I mean, was designed, I mean, or certainly gave the appearance that it was the Prime Minister, Yulia Tymoshenko, who had resolved the issue. I mean, she was the one in Moscow on January 17 and then again on January 19 to do the deal. Now, I actually have to say I find the effort here to use this to discredit Yushchenko and the fact that there was so much effort going to that a little bit odd. In that if you followed Ukrainian politics over the last year, it's pretty clear that Viktor Yushchenko is very unpopular. I mean, his popularity ratings are in the low single digits. There was a poll that was conducted in late December, early January, that had his rating in a presidential race at 2.9%. He came in fifth in a field of six. I think most Ukrainian analysts would say, you know, Viktor Yushchenko probably is going to be a one-term president. Based on the polls that you're reading now. So it does raise the question, you know, why did Russia devote a certain part of this effort to sort of discrediting Yushchenko? And this is one of those unknowns. I mean, this could be reflecting of just that deep personal animus in the Kremlin towards Yushchenko. It also could be a fact that, you know, maybe the Kremlin doesn't really understand Ukraine all that well, which I think has happened in the past. We saw in 2004 that Moscow did not seem to be particularly smart about developments in Ukraine both before and after the Orange Revolution. So it does raise some questions about that. Finally, it's not clear to me that the Russians thought through how this would play with the Ukrainian public. And again, the effort that was being portrayed to Europe that this gas cutoff is because of Ukraine, I'm not sure that they thought through, you know, the impact that had on Ukrainian public opinion. And at least the first poll I've seen suggests that, in fact, this has not worked to Russia's advantage in Ukraine. There was a poll that was conducted, I think, between January 10 and January 16, where they asked Ukrainians what were the motivations behind this. And over 26% of the respondents said, this is a Russian attempt to gain control of our gas transportation system. Another 26% said this is reflective of a Russian attempt to gain control of Ukraine as a country. When they asked what should Ukraine do about it, 48% of the population basically argued or agreed that Ukraine should pay a European price, although we don't know what the European price is, but that it would be better for Ukraine to pay a European price and be not less dependent on Russia, and only 21% arguing that the dependency on Russia was worth the lower price. So whatever was going on here in terms of the Russian posturing, I don't think it had an intended impact on the Ukrainian public. Some set of observations about Ukraine. I mean, certainly Ukraine was also doing posturing, a lot of effort to outreach to European leaders. And I think there was an effort by some elements in Kyiv really to use this episode to try to depict, you know, we have a bully in the neighborhood. And it ties in with, you know, you saw Russia go after Georgia in August. Now it's Ukraine's turn. And some effort to generate an impression that this is really a repetition or a replication of 2006. And in this case, I mean, Ukraine, and this, I think, was a big difference between this episode in 2006, in that Ukraine was much better prepared, is that there had been an effort over 2008 really to stockpile gas. So the Ukrainian government had, I think, about 13 to 15 billion cubic meters and talked as if it could actually weather the crisis and go 3, 4, 5 months without having to rely on Russian imports. Now, I think the more interesting dynamic in Kyiv was internally, because the Russians seemed to be relatively unified, at least as regards the stance towards Ukraine. But this played out in Kyiv against a backdrop of really large divisions between President Yushchenko and Prime Minister Tymoshenko that go back a year. I mean, virtually within weeks after Tymoshenko became prime minister, there was an effort by the presidential administration to begin to undercut her. And so you had this division in Ukraine. I mean, there was a brief appearance of unity on January 1 where they put out a joint declaration on the gas dispute. But that unity, you know, fairly quickly broke down with each of them trying to jockey and position themselves with the idea of, you know, I can attain the better agreement for Ukrainian interests. Now, I think this division was to Ukraine's disadvantage. It created opportunities for Ukraine, for the Russians, to play one side off against the other. And I think we saw that very clearly in the focus that the Russians gave to engaging the prime minister in the endgame as finding a solution. I also think, though, that this division here, you know, probably didn't help the Ukrainian case with Europe. Ed's mentioned that, you know, the sides seemed to be fairly close to agreement on December 31. Well, the Russian narrative that was put out was that they, in fact, were close to agreement, down to a difference of $235 with $250 when the presidential administration ordered the Ukrainian negotiators home. Tymoshenko basically put out publicly a very similar narrative. And so, again, I think this is reflective of the differences between the prime minister and the president, which did not work to Ukraine's advantage. Certainly, a big part of the fight was over the question of Rosenergo and its role. Tymoshenko has been extremely clear going back to last spring that she wanted to see Rosenergo out of the business. And there are a couple of interpretations. I mean, one interpretation on this is that, you know, she really wanted to make the system more transparent and such. You know, others say, well, it's just because, you know, she didn't have the links to the people who were tied closely to Rosenergo. But I do agree with Ed that I think one of the positive developments here is that Rosenergo is not going to be an intermediary in the future. Now, I guess the last question I would ask is, although it looks like there's a deal set here, the commentary from the presidential administration does suggest that there's a certain amount of effort to second-guess the agreement that Tymoshenko struck in Moscow, questioning the price, whether she really did indeed get the best price for Ukraine's interests and such. And it'll be interesting to see how far this plays out. And we'll see on Friday, although, you know, my suspicion is probably not too far, because I think it now is extremely risky for the presidential administration to try to undo this deal. I mean, that would be extremely damaging to President Yushchenko's credibility in Europe if, after an agreement was struck, the gas begins flowing, if he now goes and causes that to unravel. The fourth set of observations is that, you know, both sides grossly overestimated their ability to depict the other as the one responsible for the problem. I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, the problem for the Russians, and in such a sense, one of my colleagues said, you know, the Russian argument actually works better in America than it does in Europe. You know, in America, if you don't pay for something and you get cut off, I mean, that's life. But they said in the European context, the idea that you would turn off gas, you know, is just not, in the middle of winter, is just not seen as an acceptable or normal business practice. So, and I think the Russians miscalculated on that score. Moreover, after the first resolution, the first time where I think January 9, when they said, okay, we have this agreement, we're going to bring the monitors in, we're going to start the gas flowing again, it still looked like Gazprom was looking for reasons not to resume the flow of gas. I mean, first of all, although there was this agreement in principles on monitors, the initial report from the European Union was that EU monitors were not being allowed to the central gas dispatch center in Moscow. But certainly the way that Gazprom was acting, well, we need to have the contract of the agreements, we need to have the written contract. I mean, it was not conveying any sense of urgency to address what was seen in Europe, where there was real hardship because of the lack of gas, you know, a very real problem. Gazprom did not project an image of trying to get this image resolved as quickly as possible. And certainly the proposals to send through test cargoes, which were technically very hard to do, fits into that. But I think, likewise, Ukraine also did not really succeed in conveying much of a sense of urgency in reflecting the situation that, again, the damage that was being done was not being done in Ukraine because of its domestic gas balance, was able to maintain, you know, most of its heating requirements. But, the response and the posturing of Ukraine at Naftohaz didn't convey to a lot of people a sense of urgency to try to find the solution. And I think that could have a cost in terms of lost goodwill in Europe, which may have an impact when Ukraine is trying to develop relations with both the European Union and NATO. And finally, I think the last observation to just sum up would be, you know, both sides lost, both Moscow and Kyiv. The Russians probably lost a little bit more, but they both overestimated their ability to depict the other as at fault. And I think they underestimated the impact of what each country's policy and attitude and stance would have, in that both appeared to be somewhat callous to a situation of real hardship downstream. The result is the Europeans are going to be more wary about Russia. They are going to be more wary about dependency on Russian gas. And I think there's also going to be an attitude that's going to be less kindly disposed towards Ukraine. So this episode, I think, has worked against the interests of both. There is also, I think, here a big risk that both face, and maybe as a result of the Nabucco summit today and tomorrow, we'll get some indication as to how big that risk is. The snooze alarm was hit back in 2006. You know, but if Europe were now to conclude from this episode that they really do need to get serious about looking at Nabucco, looking at liquefied natural gas alternatives, you know, both Russia and Ukraine could lose. I mean, Nabucco is a negative for both Russia and Ukraine because it takes away some of Russia's gas sales, but it also reduces the transit tariffs that Ukraine can receive. And they've got to be careful, and they have, I think, upped the risk that by their handling of this crisis, there will be a more serious European effort to find alternatives that will work to damage both Russia and Ukraine.
Steve, thanks very much for a very comprehensive perspective on things. Let's turn to John.
Thanks very much, Andy, and thank you to all of you for being the hardy souls to move through this terrible blizzard that we're having outside. Terrible blizzard by Washington standards, anyway.
2 inches of snow so far.
That's right. The world's coming to an end. The title of our program today focuses on the idea of stabilizing the Russian-Ukrainian gas relationship. And in my remarks, looking forward, I'm going to try to talk a little bit about why that would be important to do, in whose interest that would be, and then some thoughts about some of the ingredients that may move the European gas markets in a direction of greater stability and move the Russian-Ukrainian gas relationship in the direction of more stability. But the health warning with which I'll start is to emphasize that the answers to this set of problems are answers that are, by their very nature, incremental in progress. Not inconsequential, but incremental. The first point that comes through very clearly is that if Europe, Russia, and Ukraine wish to avoid X number of years from now, finding themselves in either a continuation, essentially, or another round of gas confrontation between those parties. Actually, they need to get down to the business of fixing what's broken. And the challenge, not least the challenge within Ukraine and between Ukraine and Russia, the challenge will be to find political will sufficient to move ahead with that. Now, I would suggest that a systematic effort to deal with Russian-Ukrainian energy tensions and the effects in the European market of those tensions will actually require a systematic approach, not surprisingly. It will require measures being taken in Ukraine, within the EU, ideally within Russia, although Russia's interest to do so will remain to be seen, and perhaps also in other more faraway capitals, including this one. But most particularly what will not help is to have a replay of the kind of slow motion action that characterized this field of play over the last 3 years. Basically, non-existent energy reform in Ukraine, lethargic energy reform in a Europe waking up to the reality of its own supply security vulnerabilities, and a U.S. and key European capitals engaged in very public disagreements over future visions for a Euro-Atlantic community rather than a focus on very concrete things that could help to improve this situation. So to put it in plain language, it's high time for prudent and concrete steps between Ukraine and the EU in particular, but also in each setting. So let me just take bit by bit, I want to kind of dissect that, break that into different pieces. I'll start with Ukraine, not because I think that Ukraine, this is not an issue of playing the blame game on this, the experiences of the last several weeks. As both Ed and Steve have underscored, there's more than enough blame to go around to all different parties. But there are also practical things that Ukraine could do, things that are hard to do in the kind of unsettled political context that Ukraine will be between now and the presidential election in early 2010. But there are practical steps that can be undertaken that would help to improve the situation substantially. Now, the most important thing that Ukraine can do is to start to talk openly and seriously about energy prices in the Ukrainian market. There are huge problems with great consequence throughout the energy sector in Ukraine when the systems at least have the effect, and maybe they were even designed for the purpose of masking the true cost of energy in the Ukrainian marketplace. Price, after all, is the most fundamental instrument by which one balances supply and demand. As long as price is deemed to be low, one is encouraging consumers to use relatively more of the good. Now, I don't pretend to be informing you all of this fact. I'm just reminding of the most basic element here. And unfortunately, one doesn't see particularly encouraging signs at this stage. Earlier in the last several days, the Ukrainian Energy Regulatory Commission decided not to change retail electricity prices, which, after all, depend significantly on the price of fuel, of which gas is an important part of the mix. Similarly, the Prime Minister of Ukraine in the last several days indicated that she didn't see the reason why gas prices at the retail level should be increased in Ukraine, even as gas prices at the wholesale level have been now agreed to increase substantially. So you can't square this circle, just to be perfectly blunt. You cannot make this work out where the marketplace responds properly to price if you don't have clarity all the way through to the consumer about what the real price of the product is. A second area that is quite fundamental and that relates to the dynamic that Steve was talking about a couple of moments ago is the question of who's in charge. Who are the Ukrainian negotiators and representatives in this issue? It certainly doesn't help Ukraine's situation at all to have this most fundamental ambiguity that goes back to the terms of the Ukrainian Constitution about who is responsible for management of the economy. If the reality is that different pieces of the executive authorities in Ukraine are strafing constantly at each other, even as they are trying to have a very consequential negotiation with a counterparty that is, on a good day, not easy to deal with, it's hard to see how you work that out. the pricing issue relates to a broader question in the Ukrainian gas marketplace, which goes to transparency, and the link between transparency in the marketplace and reliability of Ukraine in its gas transit function. As Ed pointed out, there are so many elements of the newly done deal which are very difficult for even well-informed observers to understand. That's before you even get to the question of how much gas is flowing when and where, how much gas is in storage, and to whom does it belong. How will price changes be passed through the marketplace? All of these questions, insofar as they remain mysteries, they pose great risks to the ability of the marketplace, the broader marketplace in the European gas value chain, to see Ukraine as a reliable transit country, which is, after all, its many times stated objective. In the interest of time, I'll just dance through a couple of other key areas where improvement on Ukraine's part could be very significant for stabilizing the relationship. One area is Ukraine's domestic gas production. Now, why does that help the Ukrainian-Russian relationship? Because to the extent that Ukraine is able to reduce its net outflow for purchase of gas and to develop its own resources, which, by the way, according to geologists, are significant and could supply, in the course of, say, a concerted 5 to 7 years of investment, as much as 50% of total Ukrainian demand, as opposed to 25% that it is today. By doing that, simply, Ukraine puts itself in a more healthy balance in terms of its fiscal flows. Energy efficiency, and I say this with some grinning both at the our very efficient indoor heating today here, but also at the with an acknowledgement of the fact that energy efficiency has been a part of the U.S. energy mix that we're especially good at talking about and especially bad at doing much about. Nonetheless, energy efficiency is a critical piece of this picture for Ukraine. There are new efforts that are going on involving the U.S. Agency for International Development, World Bank, European Union, and EBRD to try to move forward on district heating energy efficiency, so providing as good or better heating services and hot water, but with much less energy consumption. That's another example of areas where further focus is certainly merited. In relation to the EU, you will be aware that there's been a great deal of discussion going on within the EU about how to reform internal EU energy markets, particularly gas and power. And this has been a very complicated undertaking in as much as energy has not traditionally been an area of core competence for Brussels. But nonetheless, this process of figuring out the liberalization of gas and power markets, the question of whether there should be a single voice to external or a more unified voice to external counterparties in energy, that process has moved forward, but desperately needs to be accelerated, as the last several weeks would underscore. I want to stress that in all of this, it's my point is not, and I think this goes equally for my colleagues up here at the table, my point is not that Russian gas, either in the Ukrainian market or in the European market, is the problem. The problem is not having that gas in that marketplace. It is a natural thing, given Russia's enormous natural endowment that Russia would continue to be a significant part of the supply mix for both of those marketplaces. But the problem is lack of transparency, unstable energy foundations, particularly in Ukraine, that then enable, or make it easier in any event, for there to be a political intrusion in addition to normal commercial relations that would be going on. And in that interest, it seems to me exceptionally important that the EU proceed with what will be necessarily incremental efforts on the diversification of supply. Nabucco, if it is to happen, and I frankly remain unconvinced that the current structure of that project is one that can work, but if Nabucco is to happen or any other project is to happen, we're talking about incremental contributions to a very large and long-standing European marketplace. Is it worthwhile to engage in that incremental pursuit? Absolutely, because it changes market dynamics. But if the Adria LNG terminal in Croatia is built, that's another step, but it doesn't solve this problem per se. New storage capacity, which has been one of the real hot elements of the gas infrastructure marketplace in Europe, is another area where further development is absolutely important. And creation at last of a true internal market for gas within the EU is also essential. Pierre Noël has pointed out, if anybody has read his pieces, that if you look at the response, the price response in gas markets across Europe to the January 2006 gas war, so to speak, if there were real interconnections and the ability to move gas from one setting to another, one would have seen a price spike, and one, in fact, didn't see any such. It'll be interesting to see what the numbers look like. I have not looked myself in this most recent escapade. Let's talk a little bit about Russia. Obviously, Russia is going to make its own decisions, and that's a point that certainly the leadership in the Kremlin and the Russian White House have been intent on communicating to people in this town and in European capitals of late, and that is absolutely Russia's prerogative to do so. But I'd go a step further even than Steve went in talking about the mutual dependence between Russia and Ukraine. Russia has, in the person of Ukraine, not only a neighbor and a long-standing cultural, economic, and other forms partner, Russia has in Ukraine, if it is able to operate harmoniously with Ukraine, has the natural least cost transit partner to get its key export, natural gas, to its key consumers, its best paying consumers. Now, for that relationship to work requires dedication and seriousness on both sides of the Russian-Ukrainian border. But if that relationship is treated as a valuable factor for both parties, then one would hope that one would not see Gazprom essentially trying to stranglehold Ukraine, but rather to find calmly, out of the limelight, off of the nightly television programs, ways to stabilize and commercialize a relationship. I mean, this is something that is absolutely in the shared interests of all of the legitimate partners in this value chain. Finally, let me just say a word or two about the U.S. and You know, obviously, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what will happen as the new administration figures out its own priorities going forward. But to me, it's clear that one of the things that Ukraine, if interested in joining the Euro-Atlantic community in some form or fashion, that Ukraine can help the most with in relation to the interests of that Euro-Atlantic community is to contribute in a sustained fashion to the energy security of our key security partners and economic partners in the European Union. If that is true, then I certainly hope that an incoming U.S. administration will re-engage with a new sense of commitment to working with Ukraine, to cajoling, encouraging Ukraine to move forward with some of this long overdue agenda on energy reform. If Ukraine fails to do that, it will be hard-pressed to make a contribution to the Euro-Atlantic community that is net positive. I'll stop there, Andy.
Thanks very much, John. And just on that last point, I would strongly recommend, if you've not seen already, the article by John and Ed in the current issue of the Washington Quarterly about the Russian-Ukrainian gas relationship, which is really terrific and sheds a lot of light on the issue. I think it's the best thing written. I'd also take this opportunity to recommend to you the piece that Steve Pfeiffer has just written on the U.S.-Russian relationship as a Brookings paper, which is also a little bit more tangential to this discussion, but is really amongst the best that I've seen to date on that. We have about 20 minutes or so for discussion. I'd like to take the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question for our panel. Your presentations were all terrific, yet I still find myself somewhat mystified as to why, in this case, the dispute was as long-lasting as it was, the gas was cut off for as long as it was. And one thing nobody has mentioned has been the background of the economic crisis in which Ukraine and Russia are being both extremely hard hit in recent months. And it's a hypothesis of mine that this has had some impact on perhaps why this year's gas dispute was so long-lasting and hard to resolve. And I was wondering if you could talk about your perception of the impact of the economic crisis and how that's affected the negotiating positions of the various parties.
I would say, contrary to your question or the background to your question, Andy, that there wasn't sufficient attention to what the economic crisis was already doing to both economies, because there's always a political perception lag on the part of political leaders on the economic conditions their countries are facing. I'm guessing that at least on the Russian side, the game plan was put together in the fall, or even summer, before the economic crisis hit in a big way. They thought they were going to win, they were ready and to go, even though the economy and the condition of the economy would suggest that they should have been more prudent and cautious rather than be adventurous. Ukrainian side is a little bit harder to understand or decipher. But I would tend to say that Ukraine probably played its hand in a much more confident and firm way than it did in January 2006, and that may have surprised the Russians a little bit. And for that, I attribute to the difference between Timoshenko, Hajduk, and Dubina versus Yakunurov, Plechkov, and Ivchenko. We had very seasoned, particularly on gas, negotiators on the Ukrainian side, in spite of Mr. Bina's reported trip to the hospital afterwards. I think they were much had held their nerves much steadier than Ukraine did when it caved in January 3rd, 2006, even after the Russians turned the gas back on, which was a little bit puzzling to some of us at the time. I would hope that given that the economic crisis will probably hit much worse in 2009 than it did in the second half of 2008, that with a political year, and we didn't mention the fact that Ukraine is going to have presidential elections, or at least scheduled for winter of 2008-2009, that both sides would be more cautious next year than they seem to have been this time around.
I just make 2 points, I think, and second to Ed's comment is that I think both sides were slow to understand the economic problems, as evidenced by the fact that, you know, for what were largely political reasons, they both sides seemed to be prepared to incur some significant economic costs. I mean, I think the calculation I saw was that Gazprom perhaps lost as much as $2 billion in foregone sales. And I haven't seen an exact number, but probably the export tariffs lost to Russia were somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion. So there was some very serious money here lost that makes little sense given the economic circumstances that we see, but may not have been fully appreciated. The other factor I think that might explain at least Ukraine's readiness, and I agree with Ed that, I mean, Ukraine had a better team doing the negotiation this year than in 2006. But there does seem to be, by the public commentary anyway, a certain degree of confidence because of the stockpile of gas that they built up over 2008, where they felt that they could manage their domestic balances in a longer-term crisis than was possible back in 2006. And, in fact, those balances have allowed a situation where, as opposed to normally importing between, you know, 10 and 15 billion cubic meters of gas in the first quarter of this year, I think they've only contracted for, I think, 5 billion. So the gas stockpile situation, I think, had an impact on Ukraine and gave them a degree of confidence that wasn't there 3 years ago.
Okay. Let's turn to the audience. Please identify yourself, and we'll take two or three questions, comments at a time, and we'll start here with Julia.
Julia Nane, PFC Energy. The Hungarian Prime Minister said at this Nabucco conference just yesterday, I saw that the Europeans should unite and then extract a penalty from the responsible parties. And I don't think this is just a political exercise, because in their contracts, they can, whoever is identified as cutting off the gas, they can extract a fine. So who do you think will be actually blamed in this and basically have to pay?
Okay. Sam? Right here.
This is a question more for John.
Sam, who are you?
Oh, right, sorry. Sam Chara. Given how you ended your presentation, you mentioned what the U.S. can do vis-a-vis Ukraine, but I was wondering also if you had any suggestions for U.S. policy, either together with
Europe or bilaterally, if we can do anything with the Russians on these issues.
Okay, and then right there, just behind you, Anya.
Hi, Len Coburn, independent consultant. A couple years ago, the International Energy Agency did a comprehensive review of energy policy for Ukraine. It's sitting on the shelf. It's a nice roadmap. John and Ed were fully engaged in helping Kibitz on all this.
As were some other people.
And many others. Why do you think the Ukrainians have totally ignored it, and is there a way to resurrect some of the issues? Because the things that John mentioned in terms of price transparency, internal reforms, were exactly the recommendations the International Energy Agency came up with. And is there a way to get them to focus on it again and perhaps use it as a way of getting moving forward?
Okay, let's turn back to the panel. Who's going to get fined? What can the U.S. do, and why have the Ukrainians blown off the IEA?
Okay.
Start with John.
To Julia's question, who would get fined? I mean, it's an interesting question, and it is one of these situations where clearly there will be a trade-off between what one may have the right to do and what one is well advised to do. And I don't pretend to have an answer for the Hungarian Prime Minister specifically about that. It is an interesting feature of these gas relationships that the companies in EU-Europe that are contracting for gas are contracting with Gazprom, and the delivery point is to the west of Ukraine, so it is to Gazprom to deal with arranging transit through Ukraine. So one would presume that in the first instance any legal suit would be against Gazprom for failing to deliver, and then if Gazprom subsequently decided to deal to go after the Ukrainians, Naftahaz, for damages, that would be a separate action. I don't mean in any of this to suggest that I think that that's the right answer. Obviously, the interested parties will have to make their own adult decisions about whether their long-term interests are better served by making a painful point to those two parties that obviously both missed every opportunity to end a crisis early or to avoid that crisis. To Sam's question, U.S. policy vis-a-vis Russia, unfortunately at the current moment, the kinds of things that one sees coming out of Moscow at times are even a little bit comic. Last week, Mr. Miller, or I'm sorry, I'm not sure who that, a representative from Gazprom, accused the United States government of orchestrating the crisis in today's Moscow Times. There's a Bloomberg story in which the Prime Minister of Russia says that it was President Bush that was orchestrating it. I think that that's a kind of not a serious reaction. I hope that the new U.S. administration will have better luck defanging this kind of a discussion with the Russian parties, but it will take two to tango. It will remain to be seen whether Russia is willing to have a discussion with the United States about Ukraine or simply pushes that away and says, this is our affair, please get lost. Finally, to Len Coburn's question about the IEA work, which Len was too modest to note that he very, very skillfully led the team that did that work, that analysis for IEA. Could it be resurrected? Should it be resurrected? Should it be? Yes, absolutely. But here we get down to the same kind of problem, and I don't mean to suggest a direct equivalency, but the same kind of problem that has for so long retarded U.S. energy policy reform, and that is a lack of political will. To date, unfortunately, the Ukrainian leadership in the last several years have treated the energy sector as a political trophy. They have used it to benefit individual political groupings, industrial groupings, etc. What has been sadly underrepresented, in my understanding of Ukrainian decision-making about the energy sector, is a focus on the national good. So the kinds of things that were talked about, the kind of measures that were suggested in the IEA analysis, to me, are absolutely central to the business of Ukraine stabilizing its own position with a very, very capable counterparty in the form of Gazprom.
Yeah, just taking those questions in order, I mean, I don't really have much to add to the question about who is going to have to pay if you get into lawsuits. But I think this is one that lawyers will love to have because this will go on for many, many – if they go down this route, you know, it's going to be a very tangled web in exchange. And you will have, I think, the Ukrainians arguing, saying, well, wait a minute, we said send the gas. The Russians chose not to send – I mean, this will take years and years to sort out if they choose that route. and without any benefit to the longer-term relationship in promoting the more harmonious relationship on gas transit, which is in both Moscow and Kyiv's longer-term interest. On the question of U.S. policy in the European Union, I think in general, to the extent that there is coordination between the United States and Europe on policy towards Russia, that's going to be good in terms of energy policy and an array of other questions. If there is a common Western position, it's going to make it more difficult for Moscow to try to find ways to play one side of the Atlantic off against the other. I would add the point that John made about the charges coming out of Moscow that it was really the U.S. that caused this whole thing. The sort of the nugget that started this about 10 days ago was the U.S.-Ukraine charter that was signed, I think, on December 19th. And there were references in the original Russian charter saying, yeah, it's in this document that the Americans are getting involved here. Well, there's one line in that document that addresses gas transit, and it talks about U.S.-Ukrainian cooperation to rehabilitate and modernize the gas pipeline system in Ukraine. That's not bad for Russia. That's actually good for Russia. It would allow Russia to have a more reliable set of pipelines to move its major product to Europe. But that now has been spun into another diabolical American plot somehow to undermine Russian interests. Finally, the last point in terms of the IAEA report. And this is one of the points of great frustration with Ukraine on the energy sector. That report was, I guess, 3 years ago, 2 years ago? Okay, go back to 1999, as you remember, with the advice that was being given to Ukraine on the energy sector. And those recommendations would be pretty much the same list that John would give you right now. Meter in apartments, reform district heating, raise prices domestically that you charge to reflect cost. That'll have a good impact both in terms of conservation but also putting more money into Naftohaz. Create a structure that allows you to increase domestic production of gas. In 1999, when I was in Kyiv, the local representative of an international energy major basically came to me and said, we're pulling out of Ukraine on the gas side. And he said, basically, it's because, we're looking for the superfields. What we found in Ukraine are not superfields. But he then went on to say is, but we've actually found, a lot of gas here, and that with a reasonable investment strategy within 5 to 6 years, Ukraine should be able to increase its production from what was then about 18 to 20 billion cubic meters a year to 30 and perhaps even 40 billion cubic meters. He said, this shouldn't be hard. And he said, and the geological survey that we've done, which is a stack of data like this, we've turned over to the Ukrainian government. So, again, we feel badly, we'd like to help you, but it's just not in our longer-term strategy. But they've got information. They can find the right companies. They can get this gas. The answers have been out there for 9 and 10 years, and it's been the lack of political will on the part of successive Ukrainian governments to take some decisions, which will in some cases be difficult. But if they'd taken those decisions 10 years ago, the gas dynamic between Russia and Ukraine today would be hugely different.
Very quickly, to save time and so that we can entertain more questions. On Julia's question, I think it wasn't an accident that halfway through the three-week-long crisis, Gazprom declared force majeure on its contracts to Europe. And that is, as a contractual matter, to pass on the responsibility to whoever was interfering with the gas flow. And I think given that Ukraine is not a counterparty in the Gazprom sales agreements to European customers, that was a very important move. I wish someone would file a lawsuit. It would be good if someone did that. I wish that MOL would follow up on the Prime Minister's suggestion. You know Hungary much better than I do. What is interesting about the European response to this crisis is that we heard a lot from politicians. We heard very little from the European companies who are actually the customers of us, Gazprom, as to what they were going to do to serve their customers. On the IEA report and other recommendations similarly that Ukraine has received, as Steve pointed out many times before, I'll be even harder edged than my two colleagues. I think it's time that Mr. Barroso and Mr. Peebox and others point out to the Ukrainians in a very friendly way that don't ask us for help.
Don't ask us to convene a donor conference in Brussels on March 23rd on improving investments in the international gas transit system unless you start addressing these issues that have been highlighted to you many times before. After all, we have a $16.5 billion standby IMF facility for Ukraine right now. Where's the conditionality in that agreement that forces the most critical sector in Ukraine to reform? When American leaders talk to their Ukrainian counterparts, to what extent is that emphasized, once again, in a friendly way as partners, that these are things that you need to attend to if you are expect us to respond to help you at the same time? On Sam's question, I think this is probably a good subject for a next meeting that Andy will convene. But I think part of the problem of U.S. policy is aligning with our European partners in the last few years. And one of the difficulties is this constant refrain of saying that Europe should diversify away from Russian gas, I think has been a counterproductive theme on the part of Washington for the past few years. Asking Europe to diversify away from Russian gas is the equivalent of asking America to diversify away from Venezuelan oil. I mean, it makes so much economic sense. Diversification away would cost, whether it is for Hugo Chavez or for the United States.
Say that again. It does or doesn't make sense?
It doesn't make any sense. The question is really, I mean, it make as much sense in the sense that 60% of Venezuelan oil exports is still the United States, no matter how much Hugo Chavez might hate us. It just doesn't make any sense to pursue a question of diversification when it's really, as John pointed out earlier, it's really the transparency, the commercial terms under which that trade should be normalized, should be put on international standards that we should be talking about. As long as a U.S. administration continues to work on a non-starter as far as the European major capitals are concerned, it's very difficult to have alignment between Washington and Berlin, Rome, Paris, and therefore it's very difficult to have effective U.S. policy in an area where we may have geostrategic interests, but it's really Europe's geoeconomic interests that are at stake. So we need alignment on the part of the West before it seems to me that we could have any influence.
I might just take a moment to be even more frank than Ed on this. You know, what, Steve, when you said that improved transport and pipeline system in Ukraine is certainly good for Ukraine and Russia. That's true.
It should be.
The problem, though, is which Russians and which Ukrainians is it good for or not good for? And we've kind of danced around the issue, mentioning transparency a lot, but the fact is that the gas relationship is so deeply corrupted that makes it that much more difficult to solve. So we have time for one or two more questions, comments, before we wrap up. Yeah.
Hi, Wally Hayes, independent consultant. And my question is, what happens if we get to a point of the very real possibility that the bill comes due for Ukraine and they can't pay the bill or choose not to pay the bill? Then what?
Thank you. Erika Ferrer from the Swedish Embassy. Thank you for excellent presentations. It was suggested that one part of Russia's objectives, political objectives, was to undermine Ukraine's standing and to portray the country as a non-serious actor or partner to Europe and the West. Has Moscow made it made its point now, or can we expect more sort of adventures to vis-a-vis Ukraine, maybe in Crimea or something? Thank you.
Thank you. Simon Moore from the University of Maryland. I guess this is a question mainly for Stephen. Referring to the Ukrainian domestic public opinion that you spoke about earlier, I was wondering what the impact of this had been on the sort of Russian population within Ukraine that traditionally has been very pro-Moscow. When they were cut off along with everybody else, did they still side with Moscow on this, or did they blame Putin and Medvedev for it more? Thank you.
Well, let me start that last question. I mean, the short answer is we don't know yet. There hasn't been any polling that actually breaks down on that way, at least not that I've seen. But I would note that the areas that seemed to be affected when they talked about gas outages, I think, were Odessa and Sevastopol. So areas that seemed to be having trouble, given that Ukraine had to manage simply on its domestic balances, were areas that tended to be more heavily populated by ethnic Russians. So a little interesting to see. Likewise, the rationale when Russia said they were prepared to send through 77 and then 95 million cubic meters, the rationale that the Ukrainians used for not accepting that was they said that gas would have to transit through pipelines that would then disrupt Ukraine's ability to move gas from storage areas in western Ukraine to places like the Donbas. Now, that gets to a technical level. I'm not sure. I think that that's probably true, although I, yeah. So, again, the way this game was playing out, it looks like the impact was going to land more heavily on ethnic Russians than on ethnic Ukrainians. But there hasn't been any polling yet that I've seen that suggests, you know, whether this is then translated into a different attitude. On the second question, Erica, my expectation is that this was, you know, a part of a longer-term strategy. I mean, the Russians, I think, are very clear with their concern about the geopolitical course that President Yushchenko has pursued going back to 2005. And, you know, we have seen, I think, a number of episodes where they are trying to use the levers that they have, and those are significant levers, to try to disrupt that course. I mean, they are not comfortable with the idea of a Ukraine drawing closer to NATO. Although they haven't come out as strongly against the idea of Ukraine with a strong relationship with the European Union, my guess is that's because the European Union has thus far been very clear about saying that there is not a membership perspective for Ukraine. My guess would also be that were there to be a real prospect of Ukraine entering the European Union in, say, 4 or 5 years, that you would probably see a stronger pushback from Russia, because from their perspective, Ukraine and the European Union is just as much out of the Russian geopolitical orbit as Ukraine and NATO. So I do think that you're going to continue to see this, that there is this Russian pushback against Ukraine's policy, and it may play out in some interesting ways to the extent that the geopolitical orientation of Ukraine becomes a political question in the context of the presidential election, which probably begins in earnest about the middle of the year.
Just a couple of comments to Wally Hayes. What happens if Ukraine can't pay the bill? In old-time Hollywood movies, there was this habit. They would, you know, pan through the living room, and you'd see the rifle over the mantelpiece, and you always knew that rifle was going to come into play before the movie was over. Okay, there's lots of rifles in these agreements. There's the business that Gazprom's beat, the retail organization. Is to be granted a contract that allows it to sell the equivalent of 25% of the total import volume of gas, and to do so, as Ed pointed out, to the best-paying customers, namely the industrial customers. What happens if that agreement can't be worked out on terms that are satisfying to both sides? What happens with the claims that Rosukrenergo still says that they are going to move forward in the Stockholm arbitration court? The biggest one is the one you pointed to, which is what happens if Naftahaz, which after all we know won't be charging replacement costs through the system to ultimate consumers, What happens if they're not able to stay current? Let's remember, this is a company that is teetering on the edge of financial collapse. What will happen is that then Ukraine will be forced to switch over to a regime of month-ahead payments. And, you know, again, this raises the fundamental question as to whether Ukraine, or in particular Naftahaz, has the cash flow availability ability to do that. And I won't answer Erica's question about the politics, but in terms of the have we seen the end of the Russian play, this in a way loops back into Wally's question. Let's remember that one of the long-standing other rifles over the mantelpiece is Gazprom's interest to gain effective or actual control over the Ukrainian international gas transit system. So if all of a sudden Naftahaz finds itself unable to pay promptly on month behind payments, the current arrangement, unable then to pay month ahead, then you start getting into the fire sale scenarios where things that have been long-standing, hard and fast elements of Ukrainian policy get traded away under very unfavorable circumstances. And I leave it to you and others as a group to decide whether that's something that's a good outcome or not.
Thanks, Wally, for that easy question. What happens when Ukraine exercises its traditional non-payment? And what I would say to you, Wally, is that traditionally Russia doesn't notice that until winter comes. Which is also maybe a way of answering Erica's question as well. I mean, I think Steve pointed out early in his presentation that, you know, Naftahaz supposedly stopped paying at the beginning of October. Why did it take a publicly traded company called Gazprom until December to notice that there is a $2.1 billion debt outstanding? Now, is this a commercial question? Is it purely a commercial question? Or are there other factors involved? You would think a normal commercial company might have cut off a customer who hasn't paid for a couple of months. That didn't happen until the end of the year. Is that an accident? Or is there some political timing or weather-related timing involved? And I really think that because of that, there is great urgency on the part for Ukrainian leadership to finally address these fundamental problems, even though they are facing a very political year this year, because the stakes are going to be much higher next winter, and we need the Ukrainian leadership to not take their eye from the ball, and with Western urging and assistance, if there is the political will exhibited, as John pointed out, for Ukraine to reform, to do something that will fundamentally alter the direction and the vulnerability of where Ukraine finds itself in its energy situation this year, and not wait until there's another crisis this coming winter. Because there's no easy way of making the numbers work if you constantly sell at below the price that you purchase a commodity. It's hard to make those numbers work, even if you're a very big company. And that's the situation Naftahaz finds itself in today. The IMF team is supposed to have visited Ukraine last week, should be on their way back. We collectively need to help the Ukrainian leadership keep urgent attention on this critical issue. And the signs today are not very, very hopeful, but I think it behooves all of us who are concerned about the situation to keep speaking out on it. Thank you.
With that, I'm afraid I have to temporarily press the snooze button. The sun rises in the east, it sets in the west, and something tells me this is not the last time that we're going to be sitting here at this panel talking about Russian-Ukrainian gas relations. Thank you very much to John Elkind, Stephen Pfeiffer, and Ed Chow for illuminating so much about this issue, and thanks very much to the audience for coming and asking such easy questions.